Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast. Tonight on Primetime Politics, a budget under attack.
It's about buying his way through the next election.
The Conservative leader is not alone in his criticism of the federal budget. A former Bank of Canada governor, a former Liberal finance minister are also expressing concerns. Coming up, our political panel will break down the impact that will have on the Trudeau Liberals and their hopes of selling the budget to Canadians. Also,
we must do everything in our power to expose Mr. Pierre Poilievre for the fraud that he is.
The Canadian Labour Congress drops its gloves. We will speak to the CLC president about her decision to go after Pierre Poilievre. And defending the expansion in capital gains taxes. We'll speak with economist Trevor Toome. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. The government's latest budget continues to get a rough ride with critics. Some economists have criticized it for leaning too hard on spending and taxes. And even a former Bank of Canada governor and a former Liberal finance minister have expressed some concerns. While in the House, the budget is getting hammered by conservatives.
It's all about him. It's all about concentrating more power and more money in his hands. This budget is no different. It's about a bigger government and smaller citizens. It's about buying his way through the next election with cash that the working class people have earned and he has burned.
Well, let's talk about the budget. We're now joined by our political panel, Susan Smith, a longtime Liberal communications staffer, now principal with the Blue Sky Strategy Group, Sean Murphy, former chief of staff to several conservative whips in the past, and Melanie Richet, former director of communications to the NDP leader, Jagmeet Singh, who both are now principals with Earnscliff Strategies. So hello to the two of you and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So listen, let's begin with the budget, obviously, because you have now these high-profile Canadians, a former Bank of Canada governor, two former Liberal finance ministers, essentially joining in on the criticism that we're hearing from the Conservative Party on this budget. How problematic is that for the government, Susan, as they try to sell this budget to Canadians?
Well, it's very seldom that former finance ministers and say woohoo to any kind of budget. It doesn't happen a whole lot. And they have an outside perspective and the government has the inside perspective and they have the voters that they have to deal with and have to support. So I'm not surprised that that's the reaction from some of those folks. That's the perch from which they sit and they speak, you know, to a certain extent from a certain constituency. But the Prime Minister and the government are looking at the voters. They're looking at what they're hearing on a daily basis in terms of affordability, in terms of housing, in terms of millennials and Gen Xers, in terms of school food programs, pharmacare, those kinds of things. So the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister have to respond to the needs of Canadians, and that's what they did in the budget.
Yeah, Sean, what do you say to that?
Well, it's not great to have those comments coming from those people in particular. Let's remember, these aren't just any old Canadians. These aren't just cranks on Twitter. These are, like you mentioned, the former governor of the Bank of Canada, who was appointed under Prime Minister Chrétien, the former finance minister for Prime Minister Chrétien, John Manley, and the former finance minister from just a couple years ago under this same government. So, you know, say what you will about maybe their records when they held those posts, but you can't say that they don't have an important perspective on the economy. And I think when they're speaking up and sounding the alarm, the government should be listening.
Mm-hmm. Melanie, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I think what we saw in the lead up to the budget is probably what was most concerning, because before people had an opportunity to see what was in the budget, we kind of had some of that commentary the day of and in the days leading up to it. So that doesn't inspire much confidence. I would say to Susan's point, I think as a communication perspective, people want to hear their governments talking about the things that they care about and that they worry about. So from a perspective of affordability, housing, etc., I think they heard that from their government this week. I think it's still too soon to tell whether or not the commentary from folks won't influence that, because it took the government so long to kind of say, hey, we hear you, hear the things that we're talking about. But as it relates to how they're communicating to people, I think that commentary this week didn't really sway regular people at home.
I wonder, though, if it does miss the moment. And to that, I want to, you know, the Angus Reid poll that came out before the budget was actually tabled, which essentially found that nearly 60% of Canadians think it is time for government to cut back a little bit and to not spend so much. Of course, there's ebb and flow in politics, and I'm wondering if this budget is actually speaking to the moment, as you say, answering the calls for investment, or whether or not it's completely missed it completely by not answering the call to be more judicious in how they spend their dollars.
I think Canadians always like governments to spend responsibly. I mean, that's nothing new, and that's a good thing. But I think what Canadians have been telling people, you know, polling for months and months and months now has been there's a housing issue, there's an affordability issue, there's a food security issue. So that is what the government responded to. So, you know, when you see a poll like that, you almost want to do it again right after the budget and say, would you like the government to cut back on the housing programs that it's putting in place for renters to inspire building and those kinds of things? I'd rather see the flip side rather than just, would you like government to stop spending or spend less? Would you like them to cut this, cut that, cut that? And that makes a big difference. And I think that's one of the things that's going to come home to roost a bit with Mr. Poilievre down the road, because he's got broad general statements, but sooner or later the microscope scope's going to be on him about what he would do differently and what he would not spend money on.
Mm-hmm. Sean?
Well, it turns out budgets don't balance themselves. And yeah, and look, I was hopeful, right?
We heard that from Pierre Poilievre, too.
I thought, you know, like they say, ninth time's a charm, but turns out this wasn't it. The interest rates are still very high, inflation's still high, and it is hurting people and families and businesses across the country. And the Bank of Canada is factoring government spending into their decisions on those interest rates. And even in this budget, we're finding out that the government's going to be spending $50 billion just to service the debt going forward. That's more than they're going to be spending on healthcare next year. So it's unsustainable, and I've even heard it described as not being worth the cost.
Funny that.
I think it's about choices, and I think what we saw this week from Jagmeet Singh and from the NDP in response to exactly that question of Canadians asking us to be responsible with budgets is, well, you could have brought in measures that would have helped a little bit with reducing costs as it relates to subsidies that go to, I say, oil corporations or other ways to bring in revenues. I'll go back to the question of, did we miss the moment a little bit with the polling? I find that super interesting, and I think it would be interesting to see a few weeks from now what that polling says. I'll go back to the fall economic statement where people were starting to have to renew their mortgages and they were really feeling the crunch of whether or not they would be able to keep their homes, and they were having those decisions as a family. And with the fall economic statement, we had Minister Freeland saying, we're doing all these great things for you. And it felt like that totally missed the moment. So in comparison with this budget, it almost felt like, oh, maybe they're hearing us a little bit better. So while we see the polling say, you know, people are concerned about the spending of this government, I also think they want to see the government act in their benefit. So it'll be interesting to see how that polling evolves in the next few weeks based on all of the things that the government has talked about as it relates to housing, affordability, dental care, etc. And to the question of the cutting question, I think we saw Pierre Poilievre have to answer these questions on Patrice Roy this week on Radio-Canada, where, you know, the question was, is dental care safe with you? And it was kind of made clear, no, it's not. So the more the Liberal government and the NDP is able to say, well, this is what this guy's going to cut, I think you'll also see that conversation balance out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Pierre Poilievre. You mentioned that not worth it, which I want to bring about onto the debate, because, you know, what's interesting is the economists are talking about productivity numbers and how this missed the opportunity to actually address productivity. And that's not so much what we're hearing from the Conservatives. We're hearing the lines that we've been hearing even before the budget, axe the tax, you know, not worth the cost. Is that a failure to Canadian debate, or is that smart strategy?
from a pure comms perspective, I don't think there are more than 15 Canadians who can explain to you what productivity is and what the government would do to enhance it, you know, respectfully. But there are a whole lot of people who've heard Pierre Poilievre say, axe the tax. So I think tactically, that's what Mr. Poilievre is doing. But I think where he is going to have a challenge is if he is a one-line repeat machine, people are going to get a bit frustrated with that. And as I said, the closer we get to the inevitable election day, people will be saying, well, are you going to cut this housing program? This is, I like the rental opportunity to get a credit, up my credit rating with the rental stuff. My kids have dental care. My mom has dental care. There's food lunches for my kids. So the scrutiny will be on Mr. Poilievre. He's not going to be able to hide behind his slogans for a long time. I think people are getting a bit tired of that particular slogan. There's other things for people to think about. So he's running out of rope on that particular thing, I think.
What do you think, Sean? Smart strategy?
I think so. I mean, I think the strategy you're seeing from the government in this particular budget is they're trying to change the channel on the carbon tax and focus on the capital gains tax, for instance, which they claim is only going to impact 0.13% of Canadians. And I think the Conservatives and Pierre Poilievre are going to remain focused on the tax that is affecting 100% of Canadians in the carbon tax, and they're feeling it every time they fill their car. They're getting the sticker shock every time they go to the grocery store or pay their heating bill in the winter. So yeah, as long as people are still being hit by that tax, he's going to keep talking about it.
Okay, Melanie.
Yeah, I kind of see the closer that we get to the election, I think the more propositional Pierre Poilievre needs to be. I think his popularity isn't due to people liking him. His popularity is due to fatigue with the current government and wanting a change. So the closer that we get to an election, the more he'll need to communicate then what. What is his vision other than these slogans? What will those slogans actually do to benefit people? Because if he doesn't, I think the anger that people are feeling may not be the same anger that we're seeing in a year from now, depending on how we see interest rates change or inflation change. If people aren't feeling the same anger, Pierre Poilievre will have to pivot and will need to be maybe not hopeful. I don't think that that's Pierre Poilievre's style, but have something to point to as then what? If not this government, okay, we're going to cancel all these things that the government's doing, but then what? How are you going to make my life better? And I think as we get closer to the election, Canadians are going to be paying particular or closer attention to that and will want those details.
Okay. I hate to say it, but we're out of time, although I did want to ask a question because we know that the NDP is not supporting the budget quite yet. They're holding off. Show of hands, who thinks the NDP is going to vote for the Liberals on this budget? And that is our political panel for this week. Susan Smith, Sean, and Melanie, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks.
Time now for a look at what else happened in politics today.
Acknowledge that the keffiyeh is a culturally significant clothing item to many in Ontario's Palestinian, Muslim, and Arab communities, and should neither be considered an expression of a political message, nor an accessory likely to cause disorder, and therefore should therefore be permitted to be worn in the House. Agreed?
No.
I heard some no's.
In Toronto, the legislature at Queen's Park will continue to ban the wearing of the keffiyeh inside assembly chambers. Party leaders were united in calling for the ban to be overturned, but the motion did not receive unanimous consent from all elected members of provincial parliament. As it stands, the keffiyeh is not allowed to be worn because some view it as a protest symbol, which violates the rules of the Ontario legislature. Meanwhile, the Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, was out promoting her budget today, speaking at a manufacturing facility in Burlington, Ontario.
The budget I tabled on Tuesday redoubles our efforts to attract investment, increase productivity, boost innovation, and create good-paying, meaningful jobs.
Federal cabinet ministers will be seen across the country in the coming weeks as the government tries to sell the budget to Canadians. And finally, the president of the Canadian Labour Congress took on the Conservative leader this morning, Bea Brusque, not holding back in her criticism of Pierre Poilievre at a news conference in Ottawa, denouncing Poilievre's track record on union issues.
So let's take a moment to just remind ourselves of what his record actually is. You know, for the last 20 years, he has targeted the RAND formula. He has repeatedly attacked union advocates. He has voted for back-to-work laws and imposed low-wage settlements on workers. And indeed, even before Alberta got creative with Bill C-32, the last time that we saw such brazen union-busting laws in Canada was during the last federal election, during the last federal Conservative government.
Well, let's pick up with the Canadian Labour Congress because its leadership, as we said, is meeting in Ottawa this week. And both the Prime Minister and the NDP leader addressed the gathering today.
I was reminded just last week as I sat down with the good folks at the Chamber of Commerce of this country when Perrin Beatty leaned in and said, you really got to undo that anti-scab legislation. And I'm like, wow, there really are people who don't get it.
And I got to say, one of the key ways we fight inflation, one of the key ways we take on corporate greed, one of the key ways we give more power to workers is with strong unions. You are the bulwark fighting against those challenging times.
Well, with that, we're now joined by the president of the Canadian Labour Congress, Bea Brusk. Bea, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Nice to see you, too.
Listen, you know, your event this morning, here you are as the CLC trying to get ready for an election, you know, pushing labour issues to political leaders. But the event this morning quickly became an attack on the Conservative leader. You know, without a doubt, he's leading in the polls. What are you worried about right now?
Well, you know, we want to be ready for an election whenever it might happen. And of course, we don't expect that we'll be in an election until October of 2025, but we know that it could happen much sooner than that. So we really wanted to utilize the once of the two times out of the year that Labour gets together to really focus on what our priorities are going into a federal election. And we only really meet, you know, 4 days out of a year entirely in terms of bringing everybody in the Labour movement together. So today was an opportunity to kickstart the conversation of worker priorities.
Worker priorities, but again, you took really a direct aim at Pierre Poilievre this morning. Why is that?
Well, the reality is that when we look at Pierre Poilievre's track record, fighting against workers, quite frankly, for the 2 decades that he's been an MP, it's very clear to us that he is not the choice for workers to support. And so we wanted to reiterate and restate our goals. Our goals are based on the conversations that we have every single day with workers right across this country in every sector and in every province and territory. You know, the labor leaders that are in that room today represent 3 million workers across Canada. And they hear from their members on a regular and consistent basis about what their priorities are. And on their priorities, we know how Mr. Poilievre and his caucus have voted in the past. So we wanted to ensure that we are very clear on what our expectations are going forward and to really identify and prioritize what the needs are of workers right now. We have an affordability crisis, we have a housing crisis, we have challenges in terms of healthcare delivery, we have challenges in the classrooms, and so we really wanted to take a look at what all of those priorities are, what do we need to do, which parties will be best placed to respond to those in a positive way to find real solutions that workers look for, and that is not the CPC.
Is the reasoning behind the timing, is that because you are looking at the polling numbers right now and are concerned that, for example, the Conservative numbers are much higher than the Liberals and the New Democrats as well?
You know, there's no magic behind the timing. Like I said, we only meet in person 4 times in the year where we actually bring everyone together. And so our next time is not until October. We really wanted to ensure that as we get prepared for a federal election, that we have these conversations early, that we invite politicians whom we've worked with in the past and who have passed good legislation for workers to come and speak to us so that they can hear our feedback on the legislation that most recently has passed, but also on the many, many goals that we have to ensure that workers see a positive pathway for themselves, for their communities, and you know, for Canada.
Okay, so maybe it's worthwhile to talk about what you identify as good policy for workers and what you're worried about as bad policy that might come to workers if the scenario is not what you want it to be.
So when I think about good policies for workers and things that we have been fighting for quite a long time, the Sustainable Jobs Act that was passed earlier this week on Monday is such an integral part of making sure that workers have good family and community supporting jobs that are good union, good paid jobs into the future. That is an act that Mr. Poilievre and his caucus voted against at every stage. This is such an incredibly important act to make sure that workers as their particular sector and industry is pivoting to meet our net zero emissions goals jobs in the future, that we continue to have good paying and family and community supporting jobs. This is one example of where we continue need to build on this particular act. It gives workers an absolute seat at the decision-making table along with employers and different levels of government. Those are the kinds of positive things that we want to build on.
So if the polls are correct, if and when the next election happens, it looks like it's going to be a conservative government. Given how hard you swung at Pierre Poilievre today, does that mean that you don't have a workable relationship with the conservative leader?
We will, as a labor movement, talk to any and every politician in order to advance our objectives to stand up for workers and to fight for workers' rights across this country. There are some politicians that we speak to that engage with us in a meaningful way and that want to hear what we have to say and that participate in the conversations with workers. That has not been the track record that we have seen from Mr. Poilievre. We will continue to obviously engage with every politician right across this country, but we know whom we can rely on, and we know that we have a tremendous amount of work that still needs to be done. So today, we chose to speak to politicians that will actually engage with us at that basic level, and that will champion worker rights.
Now, this current government only has about 18 months left in its mandate before the next vote. What are your priorities between now and presumably October of 25?
First of all, we have many priorities. Good, sustainable jobs is number one. Addressing the crisis in healthcare is critically important. We have an aging population. We have a lack of workforce coming up in various different healthcare fields. We have a long-term care act that was just introduced as part of the budget on Monday that we're excited about to actually set standards in long-term care homes. We all saw the impact during COVID of what happened in the for-profit care world. So we want to make traction on those particular issues. The nutrition program in schools, we are hearing from our teacher unions that are here today about the real positive impact that that's going to have on children who will not be who will be able to concentrate because they won't actually be having those hunger pains in their stomachs throughout the day. You know, making sure that we have pharmacare and that we continue making progress on that. Very exciting that we're going to have it for contraceptives and diabetic materials as well as medicines, right? And as well, of course, the dental plan, which so many Canadians are already signing up for and relying on. Those are really positive stories that we want to keep building on, and we want to remind workers of the things that have been achieved in just a short period of time. And of course, I'd be remiss not to mention anti-scab legislation. This is huge. This is something that we as workers have fought for literally decades. And we are finally making tangible progress on having anti-scab legislation at the federal level. So that is very exciting, and we're going to continue fighting for those things.
Bea Brusque, I know you and I will speak again. Until then, thank you for this.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Well, let's get back to the budget, because as you heard earlier, several economists are concerned about what was tabled on Tuesday, concerned about the capital gains tax and how the Trudeau Liberals are expanding what it applies to, and concerned about a financial plan that fails to address a path towards a balanced budget. To talk about this, we're now joined by Trevor Toome. He's a professor of economics at the University of Calgary and a research fellow at the School of Public Policy. Trevor, good to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Listen, let's start with the capital gains tax, because, you know, the criticism seems to be to expand what it applies to is to discourage business investment in Canada. What do you make of that?
So I think we should consider the change in the capital gains inclusion rate separately from the government increasing taxes on capital gains in general. Right? The main purpose of partially including capital gains when we receive them as individuals is because typically corporations have already paid the corporate income tax. And so this inclusion rate is about aligning how we treat capital gains versus dividends versus interest and other forms of income. And so that increase to 67 does mean now that capital gains will be treated similarly to other income sources. Now, one could prefer lowering taxes to compensate for that change. So it didn't need to be a tax increase. And I think that's where the concerns lie. Any increase in taxes on returns on investment will at the margin discourage investment, but that's not how we should view this inclusion rate change, which is much more about the technical structure of the tax system rather than necessarily about raising taxes.
Mm-hmm. Although, you know, the languaging around it, the debate, at least in layman terms, seems to be much more about the raising the taxes. You know, Armin Yalnızyan is, of course, a well-known economist in this country, and she makes the argument that people benefiting on capital gains are not necessarily investing in growth and the economy, essentially pushing back on the criticism. She says they're just turning around a quick buck and withdrawing their investment before it can have any positive impact. What do you make that argument?
So it certainly is a tax that applies to basically any asset. So you might be subject to capital gains taxes if you invest, for example, in cryptocurrencies that see their value increase dramatically or not, I guess, depending on the time period. And that's the type of investment where indeed it's not really about expanding the productive capacity of the economy itself. So there's certainly some types of capital gains where that critique is valid. And then when we're talking about increasing the value of companies by investing in new machinery, new equipment, new innovative products or processes, then that value is paid out to owners of those corporations. And what the inclusion rate change does is basically lead dividends and capital gains to be treated similarly. And so now the tax system doesn't bias decisions around how to distribute the value that investments create. And so in that sense, productive investments that are increasing the value of a company is going to be treated similarly to other income sources. And that's a good thing in the sense that a tax system ought not to tilt the scales towards one type of payout or another. And of course, we can have then a conversation around what's the right level of taxes overall. So I view this as something that broadens the tax base. And generally, we want to match that with lowering tax rates. Mm-hmm. And that's where a potentially valid critique of the government is at. The government opted not to compensate by lowering tax rates. But that should be viewed as a separate critique.
Mm-hmm. Separate critique, as you say. Now, quickly running out of time, but I do want to also ask another question, because there's still also this debate around the government's fiscal guardrails versus a plan to get the country back to a balanced budget. Are you bothered by the budget as it is, relying on this percentage of GDP as opposed to talking about a balanced budget? Because even if it's a percentage of GDP for a deficit, ultimately it gets added on to the national debt.
Yeah, and the measure of public finance and sustainability that economists turn to regularly is indeed the debt to GDP ratio. It's not something new to this government or unique to Canada. And the federal government's longer term outlook is quite positive. Just structurally, federal revenues tend to grow more quickly than spending if left to their own devices. And so that means there's not a great deal of concern around federal finances. Provinces are a different story, where there is some significant legitimate concern. But, you know, one could prefer lowering the debt to GDP faster than what the federal government is currently projecting, you know, getting back to pre-COVID levels to prepare for the next inevitable negative shock that will occur. And I think that's fair enough. So I think one might, you know, on prudence grounds, want to see a balanced budget more quickly, but I don't have any concern structurally about federal finances.
Trevor, always appreciate the insight on these things. Thank you for the time this evening.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too. That is Trevor too. And that is our program for this evening. I'm Michael Serapio. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching. Primetime Politics will be back tomorrow night.